Hello, my name is Sam. I'm a musician and a filmmaker, but I realize through those things, above all, I am a storyteller. I started writing these stories over 20 years ago, and now I finally have the time, technology, and what I feel to be the perfect medium to get them to you. Please enjoy The Scribblin' Man.
I only noticed him after I had lived in the neighborhood for long enough to tell who were the real locals versus those just passing through. He was always alone, wearing dark sunglasses, and he appeared to be constantly mumbling. His parched lips, eternally moving, drew attention away from the pocked scars on his cheeks. I'd be walking through the neighborhood, and he'd be baby-stepping along with his cane. I'd see him in the park, and sometimes he would be sitting at a picnic table scratching at the wood, moving his lips. I would see him from my favorite outside table at the cafe, and after a few weeks of casual observation, I vowed to invite him to sit with me for some coffee. As Murphy would have it, the moment I made that resolution, he seemed to stay away from the cafe, probably just the effect of watching a pot of water boil. Usually I am at the cafe to drudge through the unpleasant bits of my dissertation in abnormal psychology. It's nice to be around chipper people when I'm delving into the depths of eternal darkness. Yes, I will admit to a giddy professional curiosity as the main fuel for my desire to meet this man, but it was tinted with parts of human decency and procrastination, too. Finally, one wondrously sunny day, his crumpled brown visage happened along the sidewalk like a wrinkled lunch sack rolling from spot to spot. "Excuse me, sir, would you like to join me for coffee?" "What's that?" he mumbled, startled out of a reverie. "I've seen you around the neighborhood for a while now and wondered if you'd like a cup of coffee." "Don't accept charity, no ma'am." The man made it sound like charity. "Oh, it's not charity. Just a cup of joe to get to know a familiar face better." "That so? Your face don't ring a bell to me." He started laughing and slapping his knees, then wheezing. "You see?" He gasped for breath. "That's so funny because I'm blind." His laughing fit lasted a little while. Then he said, "Sure, I'll join you. Cream and sugar, please." He felt around for the nearest chair and settled into it. His hand immediately started scratching on the tabletop. On an impulse, I can safely say changed both of our lives, I gave him a legal pad and a pen to scribble with. It took an astonishingly long time to get through the line. Every customer seemed to tell the sprightly barista their entire life stories, which she was too polite to cut short. Hoping the blind man was still there, I hastily added cream and sugar before heading back outside. The blast of sun and the chirp of the birds were a great omen, but I had no reason to know that at the time. The blind man was still seated at my table, mumbling and scribbling away. I approached with a, "Hey there," so as not to startle him. He seemed to nod some sort of reply, but he kept on mumbling and scribbling. I set his coffee near him and took my seat. I watched for a few minutes, sipping my coffee and trying my damnedest to see a man and not a psych project. But I can't help how my mind works sometimes. There is a reason I am studying this field. I really don't know how much time elapsed, but I was staring at the bottom of my mug, and he was just coming to the end of the last page of the pad, his coffee untouched. I waited to see what he would do when the last page was filled. He flipped it and started scribbling on the cardboard back. He kept moving his lips as furiously as his fingers moved the pen. When that was filled, he lifted the pen, still twitching like a living thing, in his grasp, then dropped it. He felt around for his coffee, found it, downed it in one go, and stood up, grabbing his cane. "Much obliged," he said cheerily, then took off, shambling in the direction he was heading when he first walked by. "My pleasure. See you later." I waved and immediately realized how foolish it was. I finished a mental sizing up as he walked away. I smiled wryly to myself and set my mug down. I picked up the pad and looked for the first time at what was locked up inside the old blind man. The pages were filled with a script so precise and yet furious, I first assumed my eyes were playing tricks on me between the contrast of sun and shadows from the trees. In disbelief, I sat and read the life the man had left on those pages. Over the plain, the grasses waved. The occasional bird of prey dove to the ground, disappearing into the roiling shaft to arise carrying a small prairie creature as if it were a fish at sea. The dust in the wind, the heat rising off the rocks, and birds lazily floating on the rising air currents mingled together to complete the illusion of undersea life. But the young boy could never have known that. He was a wanderer. He never got lost in his mind, but he often rambled away from his little village, finding a very circuitous way back. After his first excursion, which was shockingly soon after his very first steps, he wandered back into his village at night and burst into the circle of adults in the midst of a mourning ritual over his loss. Despite this display of beneficence by the tricky gods, the boy's mother was not the type to look a gift goat in the gums. From that point on, she kept a very close eye on him for many years. He wandered off again for shorter periods of time, mostly when his sister was supposed to be watching him, but was instead attracting the attention of the village boys. He had a knack for coming back just in time to save her from the embarrassment of explaining why she was so distracted from her one most important duty. But he always made sure to stay away just long enough to make her fret and sweat. It was about this time he started to notice that as spread out as they were, these chances for exploring were as regular as the moon. Once every 12th full face of the moon, there was a festival. It was the biggest and best in the whole plain to celebrate the ripening of the sweet fruit so they could spread the bounty for the times when there was none. It was the one day they were allowed to eat as much of it as they absolutely could stuff into their faces. It was joyous. Dancing, stories, music, sport, games. And late in the night, the adults would disappear in pairs into the darkness to make animal sounds all night. The next day, everyone felt terrible. And some people felt even worse 2 days passed. Leading up to the festival, they would gather all the fallen fruit or pick it from the branches as it ripened. The best fruit was saved for eating. Some was saved for making a spicy drink that made you laugh and fall down. And the rest was made into a delicious spread they used to make roots and nuts taste better. It was everyone's favorite time. It was a festival the villagers began planning for as soon as they recovered from the current one. Dancers began putting together performances for the next festival, and the old men began the process of making a new batch of spirits. Storytellers took off in search of adventures, stories, and news of the land. The older women began weaving baskets and garments while teaching the girls not gifted in dance or song. The young men and older boys practiced hunting, fighting, and sport. And the music makers would find nice spots to make new songs around little campfires they built from a weed common in the plain. The little wanderer was in such an age of boyhood as to be too distracted to be useful and too weak yet for the tough work. This meant he was usually free to play games and run around talking to people to cheer them up while they set about their tasks. The boy loved to talk and ask questions. He only liked to play games with other kids until they started getting fed up with him winning all the time. He rarely got to range far unless he was with the women gathering or the older boys and girls fetching water. To make up for his lack of allowed territory, he buzzed back and forth across his village, talking to his fellow villagers until they had to, each in turn, shoo him along so they could get some work done in peace. He never thought he talked as much as everyone said he did, because he only talked when there was someone to talk to. There was plenty of time when he was alone and he didn't talk. He hummed. Usually it was his favorite song from a previous festival, but sometimes the gods would grace him with a tune all his own. When this happened, he would find the musicians and hum it to them. Rarely was it something they could play, so mostly they laughed and said he was the only one who could make those noises. That was fine because the musicians always winked at him when they played a tune he did inspire. It was many nights before the festival when the boy was appreciating the fullness of the trees bearing the sweet fruit. He longed for the flavor that made his tongue so happy, but he must show some patience because the shaman told everyone the fruit would make your guts turn inside out if you ate it too early. Somehow the fruit always knew when it was too early. This made it easy for everyone to save enough for the glorious day. The boy wandered from tree to tree inspecting the young fruit and after a while found himself well beyond his standard boundaries. As soon as he realized this, he climbed the next tree to hear if anyone was calling for him. After a long time of listening intently, he heard no calls across the expanse, but did hear the playing of gourds, skins, and reeds by some musicians just a little further along. Since he was this far and no one was looking for him at the moment, he decided to spend some time listening to the musicians. He crept closer so as not to disturb them. They were very testy when interrupted in the middle of playing. He finally approached the pile of boulders they camped near and stayed on the side of the rocks closest to the village in case someone started calling for him. He planned to make his way back after they paused for a break, and he had a chance to hum his new song to them. However, the warmth of the sun and shade of the rock conspired against him. The music lulled him into as pleasant a nap as anyone has ever had. Warm breezes kept the flies away, and the gentle percussion and sing-song sounds of the reed flutes mingled with the heavenly fragrance of the fruit trees. In his dream, he was bounding in giant leaps across the plain, somewhere between flying and running. The greens, browns, reds, oranges, and yellows zoomed past in a blur of beauty, while the enormous blue sky remained constant. At the edge of the horizon, he saw a flash of color. He concentrated on that spot and soon saw the silhouette of a bird flying in a pattern, exposing its vibrant belly feathers in an attempt to draw attention. As the boy's bounds brought him closer and closer to the bird's patterns, the bird seemed to change as if somehow communicating a scent to the boy's approach. How the boy understood this, he did not know. But to his eyes, the bird flashed its underfeathers in an amazing rhythm of color clearly designed to call him. His understanding was confirmed when he was suddenly standing directly in front of the bird as it lightly landed and stood with its wings fully extended. It bowed as regally as any chief or shaman. When the bird returned to full height, it was taller than the boy. It had a sizable silver beak, blue crown feathers, and a constantly shimmering and changing coat of down on his belly and under his wings. The great bird opened its beak and squawked louder than anything the boy could have possibly imagined. The boy jumped in surprise, and in the waking world, his body jumped along with his dream, and he hit his head on the little outcropping of rock he was napping under. His body lay limp, and he began to snore lightly, unaware of either a waking or dreaming world. When he finally regained consciousness, the boy first noticed the darkness, then the chill in the air. He grumbled at the awful feeling in his head and hissed when his probing fingers grazed across a mighty knot above his eyes. He gingerly lowered his head back to the ground until it stopped swimming. He rolled over onto all fours and tried to get up, Once his head was above his heart for a few moments, the loud banging in his ears and eyes turned into a dull roar, and he began to check his surroundings. Luckily, the full face of the moon was shining her luminescence onto the plain, making navigation back to his village a much likelier prospect. He rubbed his arms and legs to warm them up a bit and began his first steps back when he thought he heard an animated discussion carried across the plain on a zephyr. He cocked his head and listened intently until he was sure of the direction. When he pinpointed the sounds, he watched and could just make out the flickering of a fire. Happy for a bit of warmth and conversation, not to mention the reassurance children feel when adults are around when it is dark, he made his way toward a distant set of rocks partially blocking his view of the fire. He covered most of the distance very quickly, and as he grew quite close, he began to hear the conversation better. He thought he recognized one voice, but not the other. He crept over the rock, careful to stay hidden. "Your only chance for success is to attack with all your men during the night of our festival, just after the great feast. They will be full and lazy and very slow to defend. You must be patient to wait for the right time, but it will guarantee success." To the boy's horror, these words were coming from the voice he recognized.
Written, edited, and produced by Sam Lett. Narrated by Sky Wagoner.